Good. My name is Glenn Jordan. I'm from near Belfast in Northern Ireland, and this is my second time at Holy and the second week of the second visit. And delighted to be here. I'm very glad that you've turned up. Who was here for the first time around?
Yesterday.
First session, good. We're not quite building on it, but it's there will be a progression if you're here. Hello, come on in. I said, just by way of background to this, this is a project where the organization I work for back in Northern Ireland is called Coromila. It's a conflict transformation, peace and reconciliation organization in Northern Ireland, concerned primarily with our well-publicized issues there. But we're also aware that even as we're making our way through our peace process, that other things can intrude from different arts and parts to raise the tensions. And Brexit has been one of those issues. I'm sure you've heard of Brexit. And it has served to raise tensions again back in Ireland, raise sensitivities about the border, about relationships north and south of the island, east and west between the islands, and really there's great uncertainty about the status of the peace process and the kind of equilibrium we've achieved at the moment in our peace process. And we were made aware that faith communities were too nervous to kind of step into this area, and so we developed a project called Crossing Borders, looking at the range of borders that we have managed to create on our island and between our islands. And since we're working primarily with Christian faith groups, we are using our faith tradition and our sacred text to try and animate a conversation that needs to happen. And as I said yesterday, we kind of had a sense that some of this work has a relevance to some of your issues happening here. And I think that's bearing out. Yesterday, we talked about stereotyping. We had a look at the very opening few verses of the Book of Ruth, the story of Ruth, and how neighbors, close neighbors, nations that live close by one another can have all sorts of stories about one another, some of which may be rooted in some kind of evidence, but how, particularly when there's tension and enmity, those small little bits of evidence about one or two people or communities get blown up into all sorts of raging stereotypes that very quickly can desensitize people to violence against the other. We're seeing that again, as I said, back home, as the tensions rise about our borders, at the danger of slipping back into conflict. And certainly looking very much from a distance at some of the ways conversations and discussions and debates and arguments that are happening here, the language that is being thrown from one side to the other, you can see in there the tendency to stereotype groups, demonize particular people groups or particular political persuasions. And you have seen violence as a result of those things, because part of that process ultimately leads to the dehumanization of people, individuals and groups. Once that happens, violence is very easy to justify. So we're interested in working with faith groups, particularly Christian faith groups, with our tradition to say, is there anything in our tradition that will speak to us today in any kind of sharp and incisive way. And we've lit on the Book of Ruth and discovered layers to it that have really kind of excited us. So as I said yesterday, we talked about the tendency to demonize and the realization that that must be resisted. And yet that's not easy to resist. That's not easy to push back against. So today I want us to look a little bit at the resources we have. We already have. We're not developing new resources. What resources we have that enable us to pay attention to those we might otherwise turn a blind eye to, whether unintentionally or deliberately. What resources exist within our traditions? And in particular, I want to look, perhaps unusually, at liturgy and the role of liturgy in our lives. Because I ended yesterday with... We spoke about the role of artists, poets, musicians, and writers, and photographers, and as John has sensitized us to the stories of individual people that we find something universal in, those stories of courage. We find a universal courage in that for us all. But as artists step into political argument, what is it that artists can bring us? And I also want to include in that liturgists and how we do liturgy. It'll become clear as we talk through. So, just for a moment, and we're small enough, I think, as a group to be able, rather than having us split up into groups, to think about this question that maybe is a slightly unusual kind of question. A moment to reflect on the role that liturgy has played in your life. What are the prominent forms of liturgy in your life? The formal types of faith performance or faith practice, and how do they not just inform your faith, but your everyday life as well? What liturgy, or what's important about liturgy? And I'm just going to sit down here as well. Anybody want to kick us off? What liturgy is important for you, significant for you?
For me, liturgy can be a unifier. When we travel, at least in the States, we always go to church, not because we're so devout or anything else, but it's, for me, a curious way to get a feel for the area, for the... liturgy in their way. So I have a particular... When I was young, of course, I went because I had to. But now it is a different story because... And whether it's Catholic or not doesn't matter. I am Catholic, but I find those religions that don't have liturgy, for me, are rather empty.
And there's something about the familiarity of the words. Peggy, I was talking about this earlier, and I was brought up Catholic, and I can still remember the liturgy of communion. And even the Lutheran liturgy here, or Church of Ireland, Anglican back home, there are sufficient similarities that I can know it still. It's buried down deep in here. And there's a unifying dimension to that as we share. Anybody else think about that?
I was brought up in the Lutheran liturgy, but more recently I've attended the Anglican. It's similar in a lot of ways, but I like the Psalms part of it, and we have sometimes sing in response. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's been really nice. And then the call to, there's kind of a beginning of the service of a liturgy, and then there's different types of liturgy throughout the service. Mm-hmm. So sort of a flow.
Lovely.
I was brought up in for a long time was Catholic also. Don and I sort of stopped being anything for a good chunk. And then I said, I really would like a church community. I know that I want the Eucharist. I know that I want liturgy. And I want a church where everyone is welcome. And I ended up saying, I'm going to go to the Episcopal Church in town. It's going to go every Sunday at 10 o'clock and sit there with no judgment. And when I came home, John said, what are the Episcopalians like? And I said, well, John, I think they're slim and alert. Well, I subsequently learned they weren't all slim and alert. But it's a good place, and it was liturgy that made me know it would be there or a certain kind of Lutheran.
And I
really resonate to that, too. It's so similar.
Yeah.
I think for me, my relationship to the, liturgy of the Mass of Holy Communion, I'm Lutheran, it's really, changed from when I was young and sort of taught, confirmation, that it was a really vertical, kind of relationship, you and God, and now to me, communion is a profound, social experience, and for me, it teaches me, I look at it also as very much about, about the kingdom of God, but also about social justice. I mean, that we all get a little bit. Everybody that comes gets something. We don't get too much. the people that give more money don't get any more, compared to, society. To me, that the role of liturgy, and especially that part of liturgy in shaping me for life in the world is really, it's way different than it was like 45, 50 years ago.
But I think that's something that the way liturgy works, it's something that embeds itself in us over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Somebody, I asked this question actually last week of a group, and one woman said, the funeral liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
The funeral liturgy gives, she said, the funeral liturgy gives me words at a time when I just can't speak. And it puts kind of shape and coherence onto something that is just a time. And, it's hard to kind of talk to children and young people and young adults and say, stick this because this, you will see the value of this in time. It becomes part of you in time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir?
We sort of took a different path. One Sunday of every month, we don't have communion in the standard service. We simply have a potluck in commemoration of the early Christians that had a meal together. And that works very well in as much as you actually have opportunity to talk to people that you would otherwise see every Sunday but not actually interact with them.
Yeah.
However, right now I'm sort of lost. I did music for 45 years and had to a couple of years ago I had to stop because my eyes just weren't good enough to see enough of the music at once. And I find myself sort of lost at the moment.
Liturgy is almost the kind of mirror opposite to novelty. And novelty, it's something different, it's something, sometimes exciting. But actually, novelty can have its uses. But we need to be careful with novelty that we don't stray into entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And liturgy, we need to be careful that we don't get into dull repetition. But it's a similar weakness. But something about the patterns that are repeated again and again, they become part of you. And when they are not there, there's something missing.
I don't appreciate the repetition of it. I find that sometimes I just am not paying attention because it's so automatic. But one part of the service that always gets me thinking is the Lord's Prayer, because as soon as we say, "Thy kingdom come," I start thinking about how life for me will be different when the kingdom does come, and how it will be different for everybody. So that stirs me to think. But sometimes the rest of it just
washes through you.
But we have a lot of, you know, new stuff in the liturgy all the time, and there's someone in our congregation, she's actually a hospital chaplain now, but she did write liturgy and she still does. And it's so beautiful. We have, you know, a number of people in our congregation who write. And it's so beautiful, and the words just catch me every time. But I don't know how I would do if the liturgy were the same all the time.
I guess in something like that, it's, we don't see the benefit of it until those moments when we need it.
It's like the Psalms. I used to think the Psalms were so boring when I was young. But now that I've lived a full life, I think there's a whole lot to appreciate in the Psalms. I don't feel the way I used to.
You know, and even my daughter attends a church in an old traditional church building, but these it's considerably younger than the one the church we go to, and it's, you know, and last week Nadia Boltz-Weber was here, and we were talking about the kind of, you know, these young and trendy churches, and Nadia was determined that every pastor's wife is called Stacy, and every pastor is called, you know, a single syllable strong, like Dan, Sam. And he's got a goatee and skinny jeans. And that's my daughter's church. And she says she was mad keen to get us along. And so in the end, we said, okay, well, we'll go, I think it was a Christmas Eve service, and she was so excited because they were using a liturgy. But actually, all of these, you know, young adults with young children running about the place, speaking things together like they were discovering something brand new, and it was deeply moving, actually. But my daughter couldn't understand how we knew all the words. We've been saying this for years. Anyway, I'm interested in how liturgy shapes and forms us in that way. And in particular, in the Book of Ruth, to say a little bit for a moment about the liturgical use of Ruth in Jewish tradition. It's always read at the Feast of Shavuot, which is the Feast of Pentecost. So every year, the Book of Ruth is read in its entirety in synagogues. And in part, that's because Pentecost always occurs around the time, the end of the harvest. And if you know anything about the story of the Book of Ruth, it's centrally about harvest and the end of the harvest. But it's always read in association with a passage from the Torah. Actually, there are five, you'll know them, there are five short books in the Hebrew Scriptures: Ruth and Esther, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and it'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, and each of them are read at each of the five main feasts. And the one we're concerned with is Pentecost, Lamentations. The passage of the Torah that is read with Ruth is Exodus 19 and 20, which is the story that records the giving of the law on the top of Mount Sinai. Now think about this for a minute. If you remember the story of the giving of the law, God commands Moses to go back down to the people to get themselves ready. They spend a period of time purifying themselves. Meanwhile, some of them build a fence around the bottom of the mountain. Because God says that God is going to come down onto the top of the mountain, and if anything touches that mountain at all, they are to be stoned to death. Something of God's holiness, when God touches the top of the mountain, will transfer through the soil of the mountain and the rock into whatever being touches, even an animal. And the passage says, stone them to death. Or shoot arrows at them, but don't beat them with your hands. Don't touch them, because then you'll be defiled and then you'll have to be stoned. So build a fence around the mountain. Don't come anywhere near this. And then it's so terrifying that as the people approach the base of the mountain on the set day, it's almost like they all walk together towards the mountain. And when they see the spectacle, you know, the mountain is shaking. There's a big dark cloud has descended on it. There's these trumpet blasts, earthquake, you know, there's thunder and lightning, and everybody takes a step back, and Moses wasn't paying attention, and he's kind of left out in front, and they say, we're not going anywhere any closer, you go. And Moses then, it says, disappears into the cloud and up the mountain, where he meets with God, and God gives him the Ten Commandments. Like, it's the most cinematic two chapters of the Bible. I, as a young man, in my early teens, as I began reading these stories, it was always the Exodus stories, and it was always these stories in particular. You know, they're all wrapped up in there, the occasion where God hides Moses in the cleft in the rock, and God passes by and declares his name and says, you can't look at me and live. You can't see me and live, but I'll cover you. I'll pass by and you may see my back. Literally in the Hebrew, you will see where I was. It's almost like God wears aftershave and he comes into the room and then he leaves, and then you follow him into the room and you can smell his scent. So Moses, you can see where I was, but you can't actually see my face. Such is the majesty and holiness, and that God, after he passes through a place, God leaves that place transformed just by the fact that he's moved through it. And all that holiness comes down onto the top of Mount Sinai, and the people are terrified. So imagine, if you're a filmmaker, how you would film it, or your photographer, John, I don't know how you would capture that kind of... I just wouldn't know how to do it. It's huge. Like, it's world-shaking and world-making. And then you turn and you read the Book of Ruth. And the Book of Ruth about three widows, and about being hungry, and about how you make your way in the world when you're an outsider, and questionable sex, and a wedding, and a baby. Like, the most mundane things, the most terrible things in some way, but also the most ordinary and small and private and much more recognizable, alongside this huge big story of Sinai. And it intrigues me that liturgically these two things are coupled. And it's two things I think are relevant in our discussion about borders and difference and diversity and so on, and conflict. And I think the first thing is that the rabbis be very insightful, I think. That we, at the moment, whether it's here or back home, we are all living in world-shaking moments. Brexit is completely transforming our islands back home. the world is being remade for people. People are rethinking their nationality. People are rethinking their sense of belonging. People are being torn apart by the language we throw at one another, and just the whole tone of civic conversation back home has been coarsened. Yeah, well, and you're seeing it here too. Yeah, no, but it's true. Everything seems to be coarsened, and differences are being multiplied. But in the meantime, in the face of these huge big things that, well, maybe you can, but I sit at home. I have no influence on Brexit. I have no influence on that political debate as an individual. But this liturgical coupling, I think, the rabbis are forcing us to think through the liturgy to say, in the middle of these world-shaking events, be careful not to lose sight of the fact that these things influence ordinary people. Make sure that in those big discussions, in those big world-making and world-shaking events, you don't forget vulnerable individuals. Because that's ultimately what the story's about. And so somebody has to feed into those and find ways of feeding into these big conversations, these big world-making events, the constant reminder about the impact of these things on ordinary people, on vulnerable people in particular. So you might want to think about Sinai, but don't forget Ruth and the struggles to survive, because you may achieve all these great things, but if these people have fallen by the wayside, it undoes the big things you've achieved. And the second thing I think it does is it suggests, and we're going to pick this one up particularly in the third session on Friday. I wonder again, are the rabbis offering us a particular way of looking at law? The law of Moses, the purpose of the law of Moses. And what they're saying is that yes, here is the big moment of the giving of the law of God to the people of God. And it's very, very easy once you have a law, once it's enshrined in law, that that the law becomes this bludgeon that kind of constantly beats at people, and people are constantly banging their heads against and falling off the edges of. What maybe the rabbis are saying to us in the way these two things have been coupled is to say, you interpret the law through the lens of kindness. That the story of Ruth is the proper way to view the Sinai law, the law of Moses. Because ultimately, the story of Ruth resolves around acts of huge kindness. And as I said, as we'll see in the next session, the law of Moses is ultimately adjusted because it had unintended unkindness and harshness for vulnerable people. So the law of Moses gets changed. But Ruth is the proper lens. Now, there's a tendency in us as human beings, I meant to have this out before you came. Let's see. There is a tendency amongst us as human beings, we don't know how to function with law. I want you to imagine that, it's not a great pen, I want you to imagine that that's Egypt. And at the top in Egypt is Pharaoh. And here at the bottom, Pharaoh and the whole system that he lives under is sustained by a class of slaves. That's what holds the whole triangle up. And ultimately, the higher up you get in this, the more freedom and the more wealth and power you have access to. But nobody in this triangle, no matter at the bottom or the top, no one is free of anxiety. So down the bottom, even the free time that the slaves get off from making bricks, they have to go out and source the straw for the bricks, because Pharaoh ultimately refuses to supply them straw, so they have to go and find it. And all of life is shaped around the quota of bricks. It's a stressful, it's an anxious, it's a troubled lifestyle at the bottom of the triangle in Egypt. But actually, we shouldn't forget the fact that even the guy at the top, it's a stressful life. Remember in the story in Exodus, the Pharaoh is having nightmares. So even up here, it's an anxious, troubled, difficult existence. He's having nightmares about famine, about what do I do? How do I store the plenty I have? So everybody in this system is leading a troubled, anxious, stressful life, whether in plenty or in lack. And out of this story then comes one guy, and he leaves that triangle and that system of organizing the world, and curiously enough, he wanders out into the wilderness. And he encounters a bush that burns but is not consumed, which is an interesting phrase in and of itself, in the context of what he has left. And the bush sends him back with a message. He tells him, go back in there to the triangle and talk to the Pharaoh and tell him, I have a message from you from a bush. A friend of mine describes it as a murderer with a speech impediment is instructed to talk to the most powerful man in the world. And the message he's to bring is, the bush told me to let these people go. Unshackle these people. Of course, it's ludicrous. A bush in the wilderness. And I'm the most powerful man in the world. Explain that to me. Well, there is no explaining. There is no explaining the bush in the wilderness. It's not a logical thing. Because what it says is to the Pharaoh, the only structure that you understand, the only way of life that you understand, you must leave that behind for the wilderness. A series of things happen, and curiously enough, these people eventually get to leave, and they too go out into the wilderness. What's the first thing they do in the wilderness? They build a triangle. They build a structure of laws to keep people in. They build a structure of laws to define who belongs. They build a structure of laws and rules and regulations for how to stay within the triangle. And over a period of time, this triangle becomes really every bit as oppressive as the one they left. So then the prophets come out from among them. And they start speaking back into the system that had happened under the kings. And say, now look, we've got to get to a place where, like Isaiah says, we want to get to a place where every person can sit under their own fig tree. We want to get to a place, says Isaiah, in the closing chapters of Isaiah, where there is, and here's one for America, where there is universal health care from the youngest child to the oldest adult. That's in the Bible. We want to get to a place where there's a home for everybody who requires it, and work, productive work. We want to get to a place where belonging to this community is not defined by your ethnicity, but is defined by your, actually in Isaiah 56, your belonging is defined by your commitment to Sabbath. Funnily enough, Sabbath is defined as taking a break from making bricks. Stepping out of the rat race of this. And the prophets call them to a new style of life. And of course, it gets that way again, and along comes Jesus, and Jesus says, hang on, look, come to me. All you who are heavily burdened, come to me and I'll give you rest. Because the yoke I'll put upon you is an easy one, not like the yoke you're carrying. And the people who run the triangle in his day start to get very, very edgy about this message of come over here. Come out of this system of belonging. Come out of this system of production. Come out of this system of pressure and stress and anxiety. Come to me and I'll give you rest. It doesn't serve the people who run the triangle, who themselves are stressed. And they ultimately end up killing Jesus because... But out of that triangle comes ultimately a new community where there is neither slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile, male nor female, where the triangle system breaks down and everybody shares the table. And communion or Eucharist is that great sacrament, that great liturgy where everybody round this table eats freely, eats what they need, and drinks what they need. Walter Brueggemann, great scholar of the Hebrew Bible, marvels at this and says, what a thing it is to have a sacrament, speaking of communion, to have a sacrament whose name is thanks. And everybody gathers around the table, and everybody's equal around that table, and everybody breaks the bread. And in the breaking of the bread, this is Christ's body broken for you. Not one person round that table has earned it. Not one person around the table even deserves it. But the bread is given freely. And the wine is given freely. The system is being broken down. And we find together through the liturgy this repeated act that we share an unmerited gift. It's an extraordinary thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the idea. I mean, that, you know, certainly wasn't happening in Corinth, you know. It wasn't, so, I mean, it's kind of, it makes, I mean, ideally that's what the sacrament is, but even at the beginning, I mean, you know, it was,
yep.
I mean, in those earliest communities, there were people that ate and
because,
people that didn't, because they wanted to build a triangle too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is our tendency. This is our default position. We will always default to building the triangle,
right.
And there'll always be people at the top, and there'll always be people at the bottom, but somebody needs to be there to remember the story that is, in the context of this one, Ruth in the face of Sinai. Slaves in the context of the Pharaoh in Egypt. Or the hungry in Corinth, where some are feasting and getting drunk on plenty, while others go hungry. And that's what we're called to, and so the liturgy becomes both a comfort for those who need it, but also a rebuke for those who need it. You don't earn the bread and the wine. And this is how liturgy properly practiced and interpreted and over and practiced over time constantly alerts us or allows us the opportunity to see The movement of God is always away from these triangles of power and hierarchy towards an inclusiveness and an equality. Any other comments on that? I thought it might be interesting, just as a little experiment, to put these two texts together. Just I sampled two pieces of the text. So let's have a read of this text I'm going to put up now in a moment, and ask ourselves, what picture of God emerges from the Exodus text? And do we like this picture of God? Can everybody see that? Can everybody read that? This is part of the Exodus text. And the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day. Because on that day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain. And after Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day, abstain from sexual relations. This is the bit I love. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like a furnace, like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. What's your picture of God that emerges from that story?
Kind of harsh.
Sorry?
A little harsh.
Just a little. I mean, holiness is this picture of holiness here is quite a hard thing. Terrifying thing. And the very specific and precise instructions, stone them, stone them or shoot them with arrows, but don't lay a hand on them. It's almost like the violence you're somehow distanced from the violence that you're being called to commit. What else? What are the things about the picture of God here?
Uncompromising.
There's a bit of that, isn't there? Yeah, there's no room here for any kind of debate with this God. He just tells you the way it is. He's a scary God, majestic, awesome, but just a little bit scary too.
Separate. I mean, the whole thing of this, that. And part of the law to the separation that has to exist, the fence, and you can't cross, you can't cross over that line. I mean, and thinking Christianity, the mass used to be celebrated, and it was like a screen, the holiness had to be shielded from the...
And it was in Latin, so that nobody understood it.
Right, but also they were behind it,
But you Catholics again. Yes, put limits for the people. There's only so much, there's only so far you can come in this, and then you're in danger. You're in trouble. And that access is always mediated by somebody else. Moses is the one who mediates it, and he goes up and down. I mean, some of you will have been on or will plan on being on multiple hikes around the mountains here, and how hard it is. There was a time, I suspect, where I could have done a hike every day. I choose not to do that these days and take a break in between. But Moses is up and down that mountain all the time, carrying messages from the people up to God and from God to the people. And it's a very mediated, and let's face it, frankly, many of our churches have operated in that kind of model of intercession and that kind of mediation. The clergy or whoever are mediating God for us and are up and down, and meanwhile you just stay at the bottom and we'll tell you how it should be. What about, again, let's read take up part of the story of Ruth where we left off yesterday. What is the picture of God that emerges from here? Not all of which is in contrast to the previous one. But what picture of God here? When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she'd been living, and she set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you've shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." What's our image of God, our picture of God that emerges here? I'm not looking for right answers, but it is just an impressionistic. What words, what images jump at you from?
Well, at least Naomi's impression is that she's been abandoned.
Yeah.
Maybe even worse than abandoned, not kind of cursed almost. I mean.
Yeah.
It's like God's been fickle.
God's a bit fickle.
But Naomi shows a wisdom in saying to the daughters-in-law, "Don't come with me. Go to your own family, your own country. And hopefully you will find a husband or some way to be incorporated back into..." Which wouldn't necessarily be expected, because they had lived with her for a long time. She has nobody else.
I think all of that's true. I find it fascinating, and it's typically Jewish, actually. I think, yes, Naomi feels abandoned, rejected by God, almost cursed by God. Yet she doesn't abandon her belief in God. He hasn't treated me very well, but may he show you kindness. Instead of, "Do you know what, if he could do that to me, he's not worth following."
Well, and she's going back.
And she's going back.
She's hearing that good things are happening and hoping she can get in on that again.
It
seems somewhat hopeful still.
Isn't it extraordinary? There was a play that was filmed by the BBC. Some of you may have seen it. And it all took place in a shed. Not much bigger than this, except it was one of the living accommodations in Auschwitz. And it was for the men. So it was a accommodation block. There were 20 or 30 Jewish men in the And the play is a debate amongst the Jews in the accommodation block about God and the existence of God. It is the most extraordinary piece. So there's lawyers in there, and there's, you know, all sorts of men who stand up to make an argument. There are some clinging to faith, even in the face of Auschwitz, but gradually it becomes clear, as more and more evidence is presented, that actually, where these men are concerned, God is dead. And how could you not, in the face of what they were experiencing in Auschwitz, how could you not believe that God is dead? And so at the end of the debate and the conversation, that's their conclusion. God is dead. They then turn to the rabbi and they say, "Rabbi, what do you think?" And the rabbi says, "I agree. God is, here in Auschwitz, God is dead." And they kind of, in horror, this is not what they're expecting. And so somebody says, well, what do we do now? And the rabbi says, "Now we pray." It was an extraordinary, and that's the end of the play. And that, again, as I said, that is a, you know, God may have abandoned us, God may have been cruel to us, but we can't shake the fact that God is still there. He is still where we're going. And again, I think something, that's one of those occasions, I thought about that when the person who was sitting up in the corner last week talked about the funeral liturgy for her father, his father. And in those times, you know, where the world has fallen around you and fallen apart around you, and God appears to have abandoned, liturgy has been so shaping and formative over years that these are the words that ultimately comfort can be found in. I'm also intrigued in this that the contrast between the great God of Sinai and all the terror and the fear, and the God who provides food, who provides something as basic and as needed as food. This isn't some great theological argument or some majestic display of power and might. This is, "Oh, my people, food." And God provides them with food. And kindness. This is the key word of, one of the key words of the book of Ruth. "May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness." This is a characteristic of God. It's a Hebrew word. Chesed is the word. And it's the loving kindness, the consistent loving kindness of God. And it's a word that is used almost exclusively of God in the scriptures. And yet here it is being used of these two foreign women. And it's used on several other occasions in the story about Ruth, foreign woman. This great God word is being applied to a human being, and we'll see a little bit about that as we go through. Another little passage of this to read. Sorry, I went the wrong way. This is just carrying on from where we finished. Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. What do we discern of God from this picture and his dealings with human beings?
God can be disappointing to human beings.
Did everybody hear that? I mean, that's God can be disappointing. Certainly from the perspective we occupy, we hold on to that. And then you read this closing clause. Actually, there's two things. God can feel disappointing, certainly in the midst of the kind of tragedy Naomi has experienced. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. What's so wrong about that statement? What's so inaccurate about that statement?
Ruth is with her. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I kind of imagine Ruth standing
in my chocolate.
look at this. You know, look what she says here. And then look. Now, it's a measure of Naomi's grief. I mean, Naomi is, and you know, the beginning of the next chapter, which we may get a chance to look at next time, she is rendered mute by her grief. She is hopeless and helpless. So partly it's the grief. She cannot recognize what she has, even if it's only a little bit, even if it's only Ruth. Her grief is such that she cannot recognize it, but she's not empty. And we, as the readers of the story, because we know what comes next, or because we have been moved by Ruth's statement of loyalty at the start, we're troubled by this, brought me back empty. But we see hope in it because Ruth is there. And then this little clause at the very end, which is the final proof to us that there is a turning happening. Remember, the chapter opened, there was a famine in Bethlehem, and Elimelech took his wife Naomi and their two sons. The chapter that opened with famine closes with the beginning of a harvest. And we see in that movement something of the ultimate transformation in the fortunes of both of these women, actually. But particularly in this case of Naomi. Because the story, which is, you know, a story of famine, potentially a story of war, a story of death, a story of destitution, a story of migrant poverty, story of bereavement. The story won't let us forget that some of these practical things, in the midst of these great big things that human beings have little or no control over, God is still paying attention. And I think in part that in the face of the political and cultural turmoil we find ourselves in, it is easy to get into a position where we believe that the only thing that is true about what's happening in our world is what the New York Times says, or CNN, or Fox News, or what's tweeted from the White House. This is what's making the world. But we need to be careful to pay attention to what is going on beneath those headlines. What's going on in and around these big people who claim to have all sorts of power and authority. And we need to be paying attention to those that are falling off the edges to make sure that their voice is lifted up and heard in these big world-making, world-shaking events. So that those who feel like this in the face, there's somebody in the story who's holding on to the hope like this. There is somebody in the story of our great world-shaking events and our political turmoil who is acting like Ruth at the shoulder of those who feel they've been forgotten by the system. And for me, liturgy is one of the ways in which we learn to pay attention. We hear of our story in the big thing, our place in the big thing, and we are sent out, commissioned to keep that voice alive in the midst of all the other noise that's going on. Any comment or question on that?
What does Naomi mean again?
I think it's sweet and full. So Mara is bitter. So for her life is flipped around to the extent that she can't even own her own name anymore. She can't live up to her name, so she chooses another one. And again, in the way of all great stories, we know that by chapter 4, she reclaims her name, which is a wonderful thing. But as I said, at the beginning of the next chapter, chapter 2, she's mute in her grief. So the challenge is to make personal what threatens to be overwhelming. We're almost done here, and I think maybe we read a little bit more. We go into chapter 2. Because here is where, in the face of the overwhelming grief, in the face of the overwhelming need, the wheel starts to turn because of kindness. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? But you know, I think this is as plain and simple as Boaz noticing a pretty woman in his field. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything other than that here. Who is that? Maybe she looked different. She certainly didn't know how to behave in the field because she was supposed to follow behind the women, gleaning in the field, picking up the fallen grain, but she was following along behind the men in the field, which was a dangerous thing to do, as we'll see. The overseer replied, she is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. We talked about that the last time. But she's never allowed to forget her ethnicity. The Moabite who came back from Moab. Like, where else was she going to go? She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. That may be because Boaz could guarantee he could keep her safe in his field. We, American farms, anybody live and work on a farm or experience of living? I mean, your farms are so much more vast than ours, but certainly back home, you fly over Ireland, you'll see these regular shaped fields with hedgerows or stone walls built around them. So they're relatively neat. And we assume these are the kinds of fields that are happening here. So how is she in danger? But the likelihood is a field there might be anywhere, anything like that. Lots of obscure corners where, out of view of everybody, where a woman might be vulnerable to attack, to rape, whatever, whatever one of the harvesters wanted to do with her. And Boaz says, look, stay here. I can guarantee your safety here. Don't go and harvest another field. And he warns the men a little bit later. Don't go glean another field. Don't go away. Stay with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. So this work is dangerous work. This is not a sweet community that, you know. And I find myself wondering why Naomi, who knew the culture, why did she not warn Ruth when she decided at the top of chapter 2 to go out into the field? Why did Ruth not, or Naomi not warn her? Wherever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. At this she bowed down her face, with her face to the ground. She asked him, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? This is her primary status at the moment. She's a foreigner. She's vulnerable. And only for the fact that she's got somebody like Boaz, she would be in danger. Boaz replied, I've been told all about you and what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. Stop there for a minute. Search the recesses of your mind for your memory of Bible stories. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. Whose story could be described in that way?
Abraham.
This is quite extraordinary because the language used here is very deliberate to recall the story of Abraham. Here is this foreigner who is being spoken of in the village in terms of the great patriarch. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant. Your servant. She's moved from being a foreigner now to a servant. Though I do not have the standing of one of your servants. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. That could be 20 or 30, 40 pounds worth of grain. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. There's hope here for these people. And the key word again is kindness. Now, all Boaz has done at this stage is act decently and humanely to this vulnerable woman. But there is a slight change in her status. They're viewing her no longer as a distant foreigner. She's now actually a good person. A servant, a maid servant. There is a slight change. Boaz has been gentlemanly. He's been kind. Now the question for us is, can he, will he do more? Because actually that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But is that enough of a transformation?
Especially when I consider, consider what you talked about yesterday, the stereotypes. All Moabites are, you can't trust them.
Yeah, yeah.
The women are after your men. And there was a third one, I don't remember. But, so that's the environment in general. And Boaz is...
This is pretty good. Actually, I mean, if the story ended there, Boaz has acted...
Responsible.
He's been responsible, and he's been kind, and... The question is, can he, should he, and will he do more? This represents a degree of security for Ruth. This is pretty good, considering her status as a foreign widow in a country that's not very receptive to her type. She should, in one sense, you could say she should consider herself lucky. But it all begins to change because, well, she notices the vulnerability of Naomi and stays with her. Boaz recognizes and pays attention to this woman in the field, and has also paid attention to the stories that people are telling about her. There's an awareness, there's a sensitivity here to vulnerability that creates the possibility for change to happen. Nobody here at this stage is arguing that, look, this is too big. There are too many of these women, and there were plenty of these women. You know, this is a direct response to paying attention to need. And again, I come back to the ending of yesterday when we talked about it's the role of an artist to make people aware, to help people pay attention to stories. It's the role of liturgy to soften us up, to shape us and form us so that we are attentive to those stories of people on the margins. Because I don't deserve the bread and the wine. I haven't earned it. Now, who out there is in the kind of need where they don't have the ability to earn either the legal or the physical or whatever it might be? They haven't got the ability to earn the right to these things. What is it I can do? What is it we can do? How do I respond? And we need people among us who are keeping us sensitive and alert and aware. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I want to wrap up here. But that's how might the liturgical life of our churches and the practice of our faith, what is there in the practice of my faith that enables me to pay attention to those who are outside of the great world-shaking stories, who are being adversely affected by the great world-making news, and learn to pay attention. I want to finish with a poem, as I did yesterday, and I'm just going to read this one. And use it as a meditation for us as we close, that the importance of attention, the importance of habits of attention that alert us to the stories that are off the edges, the stories that are off the grid, that are forgotten in the tumult of our political and cultural conflict. Because putting Ruth and Exodus together challenges us about paying attention. This is a poem, some of you will know the poet Mary Oliver. She actually has a great three-line poem about this kind of thing. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. You could learn a poem before you leave. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. We went on a walk today with Andrew and took a couple of us up just up into the woods there, and he encouraged us to sit down and just notice something in our surroundings and focus on it. We did a Lectio Divina in the woods. Pay attention to what's there. And we took 45 minutes to an hour doing this, and when we'd finished, he said, well, what did you learn in your paying attention? Stories were extraordinary. The things, the woods said to people, but memories of bringing back to life memories of deceased parents, and extraordinary. Paying attention. This poem is called A Summer Day. Does anybody know it? I think it's a really appropriate one for Holton. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper, this grasshopper, I mean? The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Let's take a moment of silence just to maybe reflect on that last question. What are we going to do with our life? Our one wild, simple, precious life in the context of these world-making and world-changing, the world-changing tumult of Washington, our culture, and our history at this time. How will I pay attention? Who am I listening to that is turning my eyes away from the magnetic pull of the news and Twitter and loud voices, away from there to the margins? How am I paying attention? Amen. Thank you.
Thank you.